It's The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry in for Tanzina Vega this week. And America is back. That's the message President Joe Biden has been advancing during his first trip abroad since taking the oath of office. Here he is on Sunday in Cornwall, England, following the G7 summit.
And I conveyed to each of my G7 counterparts that the United States is going to do our part. America is back at the table.
Indeed, the Biden administration thus far has represented a meaningful return to an active, diplomatic, even muscular American presence in global affairs. Think about the 100-day mark. At that point, Foreign Policy magazine talked with a diverse panel of experts who graded the Biden administration on its foreign policy. Biden earned an A for restoring foreign alliances, an A- for his trade policy, and a B+ for his management of the global pandemic and his response to human rights issues. The only C marring Biden's international report card was awarded because, quote, in the Middle East, it's not yet clear what being back will mean, unquote. Something else is back. Joe Biden. Even a glimpse of the last few days makes it pretty obvious that Joe Biden is loving being president. Biden's long public career has been marked by more than its share of tragedy. From the 1972 car crash that claimed the lives of his wife and infant daughter, to the 2015 death of his beloved son, Beau Biden. But somehow, despite these gut-wrenching losses, Biden is not a tragic figure. Instead, he's resilient to the point of being, well, to quote Biden himself, corny. Again, here's the president in Cornwall on Sunday.
And I pointed out, and I mean this sincerely, we're unique as a country. We're unique in the sense that we're not based on ethnicity or geography or religion. We're one nation that said we organized on an idea. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men and women are created equal. Sounds corny, but it's real.
Classic Biden. I mean, sure, he is the guru of gaffe, and the remnants of a childhood stutter mean no one would describe him as eloquent. But when Joe Biden is in the groove, when he's having a good time, you just can't miss it. Remember this moment back in 2010, when then Vice President Biden introduced President Obama following passage of the sweeping Affordable Care Act. He got so caught up in the moment that Biden stage whispered a bleep bomb into an open mic. And my personal, all-time favorite Joe Biden is having a great time moment, the 103rd NAACP Annual Convention in Houston, Texas, way back in 2012. Not only did he walk on the stage with this classic track, but he then walked down memory lane while acknowledging a former colleague from Delaware in the audience.
I went through the battle with Mouse. Mouse, are you out there? Hey, Mouse, how you doing, man? Mouse and I go back a long way to the days when I was a public defender. Even before that, when the days I was the only white employee in the East Side. Remember, Mouse? And by the way, Mouse got my back a bunch of times. But at any rate.
That is the Joe Biden who showed up this week in England and Brussels. Patriotic, corny, personable. Even facing the considerable challenges of a global pandemic, climate change, economic upheaval, and Mideast uncertainty, Joe Biden is loving this international trip. Need evidence? Lisa Desjardins of PBS NewsHour noted via Twitter on Monday that, quote, in Brussels, Biden is running about 2.5 hours late for his scheduled news conference at this point. Talks with foreign leaders, all going long. It's a classic Biden trait, unquote. Now, all of this has me thinking about the foundational political science study, Presidential Character, written by James Barber back in 1972. In it, Barber offers a typology of modern American presidents, categorizing them as active or passive, positive or negative, and arguing that character, worldview, and style are important predictors of presidential success. With Joe Biden showing all the signs of being an active, positive president on the world stage, what does this mean for America being back at the table? Joining me now is Nihal Tusi, foreign affairs correspondent at Politico. Welcome back.
Hi
to
there.
The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
And also joining me is Barbara Perry, director of presidential studies at the University of Virginia Miller Center. Barbara, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Great to be with you, Melissa.
So, Barbara, I want to start with you. We were actually tweeting about this yesterday, that we're going back in time to classic political science, Barbara fourfold table. Do you think that I am right in characterizing President Biden as being kind of an active positive on the world stage right now, or do you see it differently?
Oh, absolutely. You're right on point, Melissa. And thank you for bringing up my most favorite book on the presidency. I read it as an undergrad and I pulled it off my shelf yesterday. And if you look at the late Professor Barber's description of the active, positive president, it's one of much activity and enjoyment of it. And the way you just described Joe Biden abroad puts him right squarely in that category.
And so, Neuha, let me come to you on this, because I'm wondering, you know, as I'm watching it, I'm thinking, this guy seems like he's really, even with all the difficulty, enjoying this process. And I'm wondering what his international counterparts are feeling. What has their reception of President Biden been?
Well, you got to remember, it depends on who you're talking about, right? I mean, if you're China and you're Russia, you may not be feeling the same thing as if you're France or Germany. But the allies are largely feeling a sense of relief. I mean, this is a guy who's going to be nice to them. He's not going to beat up on them. He's not going to refuse to sign on to things like fighting climate change with them. So overall, it's relief. It's happiness that there's a better tone when it comes to U.S. allies. But again, if you're China or if you're Russia or certain other countries, you may not be that thrilled.
Right. I take that point clearly. Barbara, let me come to you on this, because I think that's a lot of the transition that we've seen, particularly in his conversations in Brussels yesterday. So I'm thinking of the fact that there President Biden was quoting an Irish American, was quoting an Irish poet and talking about how the world has utterly changed and trying again to bring the U.S. back to the table, this time around issues of trade with the EU. Is this kind of what Biden is describing as like values-driven approach to international politics? Has this typically been successful, at least with the allies?
Oh, I think so. And I think that this is what disturbed people so much, if they happen to be in the Biden camp in terms of internationalism and multilateralism in foreign affairs, that if you do look at that, I think with an objective eye from World War II onward, with things like NATO, with these alliances, it's not America first. It's not walling ourselves in and being isolated. How did that work out for us in the 1920s? And so it really kept the peace. I think most people would like to go back to that. And I think that that's where Joe Biden is taking us. And I think that's why the allies that we have in that part of the world are thrilled that we are back, and that there is some consistency now, I think, in what has been the approach from Democrats and Republicans from World War II's end onward to now.
Indeed, foreign policy, it seems to me, Neuha, is one of the places that had not been so partisan, politicized previously, that there had been a sense of, again, politics stopping at the water's edge, that there was some sense of enduring American interests. So talk to me about China within that sort of perspective. What is the the consistencies between the Biden administration and the previous administration, the Trump administration, relative to China?
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. I mean, oftentimes when you think of Trump and Biden, you think, wow, they're just so incredibly different. Trump was in so many ways just wildly different than what the world expected from an American president, from U.S. foreign policy. He questioned everything from the existence of NATO to, whether or not we can be really, really close with dictators and be completely fine with that. I mean, it was everything from human rights to whatever. But China is one issue that is definitely consistent between the two. There is a general agreement on both sides, Republican and Democrat in Washington, that the Chinese pose the most significant geopolitical threat to the United States as really exists. And China is such a fascinating issue because it covers every single topic you can think about, everything from higher education to technology to flat out potential, you know, kinetic military issues in and around Taiwan. So it's one of those things where the U.S. just feels like the Chinese, with their authoritarian model in particular. I mean, that's the issue here, to be clear. It's their governance system. It's their oppressive tactics. It's just behavior on a number of levels, the human rights abuses, all sorts of things that have really alarmed people in Washington. And that's why you see Biden, for now, keeping on the tariffs, keeping on the sanctions that President Trump laid on to China. They, you know, Biden and Trump may have somewhat different aims when it comes to China, but overall, in terms of tactics, they're sticking to the same thing.
Now, but one of the places where I think there's at least more discursive divergence, but also likely in policy, is Russia. Can you maybe lay out the Biden versus Trump Russia approach?
Yeah, I mean, look, when you look at it on a personal level, Trump himself really felt like he wanted to get along with Vladimir Putin, wanted to make it like a personal relationship, did not believe or said he didn't believe the allegations that the Russians interfered in the 2016 election. Now, Trump's administration, though, they did, you know, over time, levy more sanctions on Russia. They did take a number of tough positions on Russia, largely because they were pushed by Congress to some degree. Biden has a very different point of view. Going back, I mean, I did research on this, going back like to the beginning, like within weeks of Vladimir Putin becoming acting president of Russia back in 2000, Biden was saying, I don't really know about this guy. I'm not sure this guy is really a Democrat in any sense, in small d democracy. That has stayed consistent. He has, for 20 years, consistently said he doesn't really trust Putin. He doesn't. He isn't exactly sure, you know, whether democracy is possible when it comes to Putin. And so over time, Biden has, you know, felt that. But that being said, he knows Putin is someone that he's going to have to deal with. And so that's why he is going to meet with him this week. And so, you know, what we're going to see, I think, continued existing sanctions, but possibly even more sanctions on Russia going forward. But a lot of it also depends on what Putin does.
It's a values-driven, high-standard, transparent financing mechanism we're going to provide and support projects in four key areas: climate, health, digital technology, and gender equity. And we believe that will not only be good for the countries, but be good for the entire world and represent values that our democracies represent.
You're listening to President Biden during his Sunday press conference describing the Build Back Better World Partnership, or as they're calling it, B3W. So I want to come to you, Barbara, because as long as we're hanging out in old-fashioned political science, I was also thinking of John Aldrich asking that question about presidents and foreign affairs. Are presidents simply waltzing before a blind audience? All this work they're doing on the global stage, but American voters, American citizens don't often pay a lot of attention. What is happening with Biden in terms of his attempts to message what he's doing globally back home?
Well, I'm going to add another political science wrinkle here. And I know you'll know this book by the late Richard Neustadt called Presidential Power. And he famously said the power of the president is the power to persuade. First, persuade the electorate to get elected, get nominated and get elected, and then think of all the constituencies to be convinced and persuaded by the president, including foreign leaders, but obviously the people back home. So I think by pointing to these values, as you've just played this clip from Biden on health and technology and gender equity and climate, that's why he was elected. That's why he was nominated by his party. And so he's not only trying to carry this through on the domestic stage, but on the world stage. And at least on the world stage, first of all, he does have power of persuasion. And second, he also is able to act in some ways unilaterally, at least as compared to acting at home when he's got to deal with Congress and the Supreme Court, media, et cetera.
Yeah, it seems to me, Barbara, that must be part of why it is sort of more fun for presidents to be doing, you know, the global work is they actually don't have to wait for a filibuster-proof, you know, policy. They can actually go sit down at the table, have those relationships. And I'm wondering in that if it is, if this will suggest that maybe given how tense things are in D.C. and unlikely to be different if Biden's going to really end up being a very externally focused president?
Well, I think you'll have to be both, as we saw with COVID. I mean, who would have known 2 years ago that that was going to have to be at the top of the agenda? And that is at the top of the agenda at home and abroad. So there'll be issues like that. But I think you're absolutely right, Melissa, that all presidents prefer to deal, unless it's in a wartime situation or there's just a horrible foreign policy crisis. But even if there is a crisis, again, short of war, they get to act, and sometimes even in war, they get to act rather unilaterally. So I think that's why presidents prefer it. And I think someone like Biden, who has this really interesting combination of both foreign affairs experience from his time in the Senate, his 8 years as vice president, but he also has this interesting character as part of the Barber approach, that he's sort of like a mayor, an old Irish Paul mayor of Boston or, a northeastern city. So he's got that personal touch, sometimes literally and beyond the bounds of propriety these days. But that, I think those combinations make him the perfect actor on the world stage, and obviously, at least at home, getting elected on the domestic stage.
So, Nihal, he may really need those sort of personal touch, retail politics strengths in his relationship with the new prime minister of Israel. So he actually reached out. He called Naftali Bennett within hours, whereas it had taken him months to call Netanyahu. I'm wondering if you have insights on what this relationship may look like going forward.
I think what we'll see change is probably more tone than substance. I mean, Naftali Bennett is probably further to the right than Benjamin Netanyahu was on a lot of issues. His new government is not going to support the Iran deal, the Iran nuclear deal, the same way Netanyahu didn't. There are definitely going to be continued differences between the U.S. and Israel. But I think the difference will be that, Bennett and his people, his foreign minister, others aren't necessarily going to come and make a speech before Congress designed to humiliate the U.S. president or take other steps that, you know, really, really emphasize these differences. They'll probably try to do it more behind the scenes, privately, that sort of thing. Look, what we really have to also watch, though, is the ongoing conflict between the Israelis and the Palestinians, and how whatever happens with that, like if it stays calm or if it explodes again, how the government of Israel reacts and how the U.S. reacts then as well. So there's just a lot of, it's weird. It's like there's these known unknowns, you know, like we know what to watch for, but we don't know what's going to happen. So you know, that's what I would say is it's more about tone than substance.
So Nihal, do that known unknown relative to Afghanistan with me. Has Biden been meeting resistance about that decision to remove U.S. troops?
You know, from what I have read, it sounds like people are basically accepting it. I mean, he seems dead set on it, and NATO and others are basically just trying to figure out how to leave alongside the U.S. while, you know, keeping some form of security inside the country so that their embassies can continue running, that sort of thing. And I think you're probably going to see at some point, you know, U.S. air support of some kind for the Afghan army. But that's going to require finding bases, possibly even in Central Asia. And it's there's a lot that, frankly, still needs to be worked out. But the general idea that the U.S. and NATO are going to be out, I think that's pretty much agreed to.
So, Barbara, for our last question, I just want to ask you to do that known, those unknown knowns in the domestic context a bit too. What are you looking for from President Biden over the course of the rest of this year?
Well, I think transitioning from COVID at the top of the list, we have to see if we have any more outbreaks there, and obviously continue that vaccine message, and then getting that vaccine around the world, getting the economy back, seeing if he can get something done with the Republicans on infrastructure, and see if he can apply those values that he named off abroad at home.
Absolutely. Nihal Tusi is a foreign affairs reporter at Politico. Barbara Perry is the director of presidential studies at the University of Virginia Miller Center. And apparently she and I are making a old-fashioned political science syllabus for everybody to read. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you, Melissa.
On Sunday, Israel's parliament officially ousted Benjamin Netanyahu, ending his 12-year tenure as the country's prime minister. Taking his place is far-right politician Naftali Bennett.
Naftali Bennett.
Ben Jim Yaakov,
son of Jim Yaakov of blessed memory, and Mirna Leah, may she have a long life, commit as the Prime Minister and as the future alternate Prime Minister to maintain allegiance to the State of Israel and to its laws.
Bennett has described himself as, quote, more right-wing than Netanyahu, but his coalition government includes members of centrist parties as well as the first Arab party to join an Israeli-majority coalition. And while it may be hard to see how this widely divergent coalition can effectively govern, it's pretty clear the Biden administration is hoping they'll succeed. Around 2 hours after Bennett became prime minister, President Biden called to congratulate him. That's a sharp contrast to the roughly 2 months it took Biden to call Netanyahu after being sworn in back in January. For more on this, I'm joined by Noga Tartopolsky. She's a freelance reporter based in Israel who writes for the Los Angeles Times and the Daily Beast. Noga, so great to have you back on the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
So what should people in the U.S. know about Israel's new governing coalition?
Well, it's being generally described as a kind of a patchwork and a nonsensical government because it really does go from the strong left of the Israeli political arena all the way to the Islamic Movement party that you mentioned through pretty nationalist mainstream parties. But I have to say, I think they have a shot. I think we should not underestimate the extent to which the Israeli public was exhausted by the last few years of Netanyahu, and also the extent to which these eight leaders, the eight party leaders, were genuinely fearful for Israel's future if Netanyahu was not removed. And by that, I don't mean disliked him personally. I mean, they have a strong sense now that their ministries and the institutions of the state need rebuilding. So that could become a national project.
So what do you make of President Biden calling Bennett so quickly as compared to the time it took him to speak with Netanyahu?
I think the Biden administration pretty evidently is breathing a sigh of relief. Netanyahu is a strange political character because when he began in office 12 years ago, he was lauded as almost American. He has a degree from MIT. He speaks pretty much flawless English. Some people say his English is better than his Hebrew even. And he brought a kind of American style of campaigning to Israel, American style of branding as a politician. And yet, in the last few years, as he's gotten embroiled in his trial, he's on trial for corruption charges, and as he did this big swing between being extremely aggressive against President Obama and then being, I would say, extremely friendly with President Trump. He was President Trump's closest international ally. It's as if something got unbalanced in the relationship. And the Biden administration was taking a cautious approach.
And in this moment with Bennett, with his hardline views on Iran and on the two-state solution with Palestinians, is this going to make it hard for the Biden administration, despite the fact there may be a sigh of relief about no longer working with Netanyahu?
It could, and I think we really are just going to have to wait and see on that.
Noga Tartopolsky is a freelance reporter based in Israel. She writes for the Los Angeles Times and the Daily Beast. Noga, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Noga also has an opinion piece on Israel's new prime minister, Naftali Bennett, that is in the New York Times today. Check it out.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
We turn now to Nicaragua, where the political crisis continues to worsen ahead of November's presidential election. Opposition leaders have been attempting to get on the slate to challenge President Daniel Ortega. But in the past month, Ortega's government has arrested 4 presidential candidates.
Si están viendo este video es porque he sido incomunicado o capturado.
That's Juan Sebastian Chamorro, one of the 4 presidential pre-candidates who was arrested earlier this month. In the video, he's saying that if we are watching this video, it is because he has been captured.
A mi querida familia, les digo que no se preocupen, que voy a estar bien. Estoy preparado espiritualmente, mentalmente y físicamente para lo que viene.
He's addressing his family, telling them not to worry, that he will be okay, that he was spiritually, mentally, and physically prepared for what may come.
We haven't seen our brother for 6 days now. We haven't been able to see him nor his lawyers, so we're concerned.
That's Ana Maria Chamorro, Juan Sebastian's sister. We spoke on Monday, and she described the events leading up to his arrest.
He had a summons in the prosecution's office on June 9th at 8:30 in the morning, and he knew that he was going to be arrested because the same thing happened to another candidate. But the night before, at 7:15, he was home with his wife, and 40 cops came into his house, very aggressive. They took him. We didn't know where they were taking him, and they spent about 4 hours searching his house with my sister-in-law in it, so we didn't know anything about her for 4 hours.
Ana Maria has not been able to contact her brother since his arrest.
We go every day to a detention center to bring him food. For the last 3 days, they told us that he didn't need any food anymore, so they just let us leave water for him. We're going to keep going, insisting on seeing him, and until I see him, I'll be okay.
Since 2018, after the Ortega administration began implementing austerity measures, mass protests have taken hold of Nicaragua. And Ana Maria and her family have seen President Ortega only escalate his response to the movement in opposition to him.
Well, lately, it's not normal. Since 2018, things have changed, and there's a lot of repression. You cannot go out on the street with the Nicaraguan flag. If you do, you go to jail. So it's pretty bad.
Cristiana Chamorro Barrios is also a pre-candidate for the presidency and was recently placed under house arrest. Cristiana, Ana Maria, and Juan Sebastian come from a well-known family in Nicaragua. Tensions between Ortega and the Chamorros are decades old. Back in 1990, after 6 years of Ortega's first term, Violeta Chamorro defeated him in an election.
I think it's something in our blood. It's been in the history of Nicaragua for more than 100 years. So when my brother took the decision, it's because he wants his country to be free and to have all the opportunities that we should have, you know, to be free.
Speaking out about the situation is a risk for Ana Maria and her relatives. Already 12 people opposing Ortega have been arrested this month.
I'm not fearful for me, but there's always a possibility, you know, of being arrested. So that's the chance I'm willing to take to let the world know about the violations that have been made to my brother.
And as Ana Maria and I were speaking, she made an appeal.
I believe that we can use our social medias to put all over the world that this is going on. So there's a lot of pressure, you know, for them to let them see us.
Here to help us understand the context of this crisis is Anatoly Kormanayev, who is Mexico and Central American correspondent for The New York Times. Anatoly, thank you so much for being here.
Pleasure to be here.
I'd like to step back for just a moment. So Nicaragua's President Daniel Ortega has been in power since 2007. What has the last decade and a half been like for Nicaragua under his administration?
Since he came back to power as a democratic leader, we've seen a gradual erosion of political rights, of civil rights. But it also happened in the context of a relatively free economy. Nicaragua is quite different from other authoritarian regimes in Latin America, like Cuba or Venezuela, in that private sector has a leading role in the economy. It's a pretty open economy. It's very much export-oriented. So it was a pretty strange combination of a repressive governments, repressive, you know, political rights with pretty open economic rights. Since 2018, this has taken a major turn for the worse. There has been a series of protests that have been brutally repressed, more than 300 people killed. And in the last 2 weeks, we've seen repression gone even a step further, with the government going after the remaining dissident leaders in the country.
And so what led to those 2018 austerity measures that sort of sparked these widespread demonstrations?
Well, like many historical events, it became something quite minor. People came out on the streets to protest a reduction in social security. There was a small tweak in the way welfare payments were calculated. People came out on the streets, and it quickly grew into general discontent with the government, general desire for something else. You know, for Ortega to go. You know, he's been in power for almost a decade, more than a decade at the time. And it became this massive call for a change.
In the intervening years since he came back to power, has it been normal practice to arrest those who are considering running against him?
Well, we have to remember that Ortega didn't come out of nowhere. He, of course, was one of the leaders of a Sandinista revolutionary movement that ousted dictator Somoza in 79. And Ortega, together with other revolutionary leaders, ruled Nicaragua for during the 80s. And of course, you know, this was a period of Cold War. It was a period of civil war. You know, the civil rights were also pretty limited. You know, it was a very austere authoritarian government. So he came back to power as a democratic leader. He won in democratic elections in 2007 already with that mindset. So it was never really a free and open place, but it's certainly been gradually taking a turn for worse as his time and power went on.
So you've given us a bit of that history. Can you help the U.S. audience to also understand the ways that the United States was involved in some of that history?
Well, of course, you know, during the 80s, you had a civil war against U.S.-backed Contras, you know, right-wing paramilitaries, of course. So yes, I mean, there's, of course, a history of U.S. involvement in the region, a history of Soviet Union's involvement in the region, which has destabilized the country for decades. And we are living, in many ways, the consequences of the time. You know, a lot of the players on the stage today are the same. Ortega, of course, came from a period, the Chamorro family that has been repressed at the moment. They were supporters of a revolution. You know, many of the Chamorros played a part in a revolutionary junta with Ortega in the 80s. And of course, Violeta Chamorro, a relative of Juan Sebastián, she beat Ortega in democratic elections in 1990. A lot of the players, you know, in the drama that's unfolding today, go back to the Cold War era where the U.S. played a major role.
And before our conversation started, we just heard from the sister of Juan Sebastián Chamorro. And I'm wondering if you have heard anything on the ground, if you know details surrounding his arrest or his current condition.
It was part of a larger wave of arrests in Nicaragua. As you mentioned, more than 12 people have been arrested since. The details of their conditions are scarce. My understanding is that most of them are held incommunicado. Most of them have not been able to see a lawyer. Some have been able to see maybe a relative, but again, it depends on a case by case basis. They don't have cell phones. They don't have connections with the outside world. They haven't been brought to court. They haven't, you know, a lot of them have not even been formally charged. Some claim to have been abused during their arrest, beaten, their relatives threatened. So, you know, it's an extremely serious situation that threatens what's basically left of independent thoughts in Nicaragua.
So what you're describing here, not only with the detention, the harassment, potentially the violence against these candidates, but the much more widespread, brutal crackdown that you've described, It feels to me like human rights violations, and yet we just heard Vice President Harris in Central America telling people, don't come. How is the Nicaraguan crisis likely to either increase the number of migrants fleeing Central America or ultimately draw the U.S. into needing to address this?
I think this is a major dilemma for the U.S. government at the moment. We can say that this is the first democratic crisis in Latin America for the Biden administration, the first one that happened on this watch, and they have pretty bad options in how to respond to it. As you mentioned, the administration is trying to make democracy a priority in Central America, but they're also extremely concerned about migration. So far, sanctions against the latest round of crackdown have been limited to just personal sanctions against some Ortega officials, which we don't really care about too much at this stage. And the administration has shied away from economic sanctions, from basically punishing Ortega's economy, precisely because it could lead to a rise in migrants. If the economic situation becomes particularly dire in Nicaragua, we could see Nicaraguans joining, Guatemalans, Hondurans, Salvadorians fleeing their countries and heading to the U.S. border. And it's precisely what the Biden administration is trying to avoid. So does have pretty bad options in how it can respond to this crisis.
Anatoly Kormanayev is Mexico and Central American correspondent for the New York Times. Anatoly, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Do you know what transgender means?
Like Caitlyn Jenner?
Yeah, I guess. Like Caitlyn Jenner.
When someone is a man, but they want to be a woman?
It's like when you're born, everyone thinks you're a boy or a girl, but you know you're not. You're really the opposite.
In Hulu's groundbreaking series, First Day, a young transgender girl named Hannah Bradford navigates starting a new school as her authentic self.
What if they can tell? If they find out? Maybe I should just keep wearing the boy's uniform.
If that's what you want to do, me and your dad and I will take your lead on this, remember?
It's a beautiful coming-of-age story about gender identity and belonging. Hannah's nervous about her friends and classmates finding out she's trans. But when they do, they embrace her, even defending her against bullies.
I still want to be your friend.
You do?
Yeah. Do you still want to be mine?
Yeah, Combs.
First Day is just one of many queer coming-of-age stories that offers up an alternative narrative for what life could be like growing up as LGBTQ+. And for some kids and adults alike, queer children's media, like TV shows, movies, and literature, can serve as places of understanding and healing. And that's according to Alex Marzano-Lesnovich, who recently wrote about queer coming-of-age stories like First Day for the New York Times. They're an assistant professor at Bowdoin College and author of The Fact of a Body, also of the forthcoming memoir of non-binary identity, Both and Neither. Alex, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Melissa. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Absolutely. Now, let's start with Hulu's series, First Day, for folks who haven't watched it. Tell us a bit about the show and how it portrays trans youth.
You know, it portrays trans youth really beautifully. The show, as you mentioned, follows this young girl, Hannah, and we, you know, follow her through what is essentially an ordinary tween life. She is going to school, she is navigating her crushes, she's navigating her friendships, and along the way, it is discovered by her classmates that she is trans and she is outed. And, you know, as I sort of said in this piece that I wrote, watching this, I found myself preparing to cry. I totally expected to cry. I expected that they were going to react poorly. And instead, they embraced her. And she gets to have an ordinary teenagehood. And I think that is just so beautiful.
Yeah, I'm thinking of the 1990 film Boys Don't Cry, which in certain ways was like, you know, a critical, important film around youth and trans identity, but also has that that kind of brutalizing, tragic ending that I think we brace for in watching a film or a series like this.
Absolutely. And it's such a conundrum, really, because depicting the pain and violence that trans people so often face in our country is crucially, critically important. It's part of fighting for change. And yet, because there is such a need to depict it, it often means that in the cultural imagination, trans lives can be equated with pain. Because we don't have that other narrative. We don't have that other narrative that says that they can be full of love, that they can be full of joy. And so I think what we're starting to see in First Day and other works like it is the chance to do some reparative work, to say, hold on, the pain is in the culture. The pain is in the attacks foisted upon trans people. The pain is not an endemic part of trans lives. It doesn't have to be. It's coming from the culture.
I think that's such a critically important distinction. Now, one of the things I also love that you've been up to is reading YA novels and YA books. It is actually a thing that when my eldest was coming through middle school, I started reading YA books and have loved that experience and continue to read them. So talk to me about the YA books featuring trans or LGBTQ+ characters and what this kind of queer young adult literature is like and what it's meant for you.
Absolutely. You know, this, I will say, this is one of my favorite things to talk about. And as a writer, not of YA, but of books meant for adults, I almost never get to talk about it. But it's like my secret love. I only came out as trans a couple of years ago. I knew I was trans even as a kid. I didn't have language for it, but I knew at 8. And a couple of years ago, when I found myself coming out, I realized I needed these stories. I needed to listen to them. I love YA audiobooks. And because I needed to listen to these positive experiences, these opportunities that kids were having on the pages of the books to sort of live fully as themselves. And we've really seen this gorgeous explosion of trans and queer lit published in the last couple of years for young people. Certainly, there were books going back a ways, but often they emphasize pain. And more recently, we're watching teenagers get to live fully on the page. So some of the authors I mentioned in the piece are some of my favorites. Leah Johnson, whose debut, You Should See Me in a Crown, follows Liz Lighty, a young Black queer girl, as she runs for prom queen. And I'm not going to spoil the ending, but I will say it's beautiful to listen to. It's beautiful to read. And Leah spoke quite movingly to me about the way that she was writing scenes for Liz, her main character, even as she was living them, because she, like me, didn't come out until later. And she was figuring out who she was and how to live openly as who she was, and realizing that she needed to sort of follow this reparative path of Liz Lighty and have Liz have these experiences for her. Another favorite, she's got an upcoming book called Rise to the Sun, highly recommended, that will be out July 6th. Another author I just adore is Kaysen Callender. They've got a couple of books out now, but I love Felix Ever After, which follows a trans youth navigating their intersectional identities and how to live in the world as who they are fully.
It seems to me that this is part of the depth of shared humanity, these moments of transformation and coming into our authenticity, sort of regardless of whether one is cis or trans, whether one self-identifies as straight or as queer, that part of what YA gives us are those moments literally of transformation and of identity seeking.
Absolutely. YA lets us experience, without sort of cringing or without sarcasm, really authentic emotional moments. Because one of the things that teenagers do so beautifully is they live their emotions. And as adults, we're often sort of told not to. We're given a message not to take that risk, not to be brave in that way. And yet, we actually face various sorts of comings out all through our lives, right? And certainly for trans and queer people, there's just endless coming out. We actually face big moments in our friendships, big moments in which we have to be brave about who we are and we fear rejection. That happens all throughout our lives. And so YA helps teach us actually how to do that, how to hold space for who we really are.
And hopefully how to find love and not critical, nasty, evil kind of anti-trans legislation that we have seen in recent months. I so appreciate this opportunity to talk about the joyous and the celebratory depictions of trans life in children and YA media. I encourage everyone to read the piece by Alex Marzano-Lesnovich, who is assistant professor at Bowdoin College and author of the forthcoming Both and Neither, or maybe Both and Neither. Alex, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was a great way to end the show today. Thanks as always for tuning in, y'all. And of course, we love to hear from you. Your stories or show ideas. So please continue to call in at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Talk to you tomorrow.